ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 15th of April. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. A dire scenario predicting long-term scarring of the world's economy. In its latest World Economic Outlook report, the IMF has produced three scenarios that get progressively worse depending on how long Middle East energy supplies are disrupted. Shane Oliver is chief economist at AMP. He joined me a short time ago. Shane Oliver, the IMF has warned the war in Iran has turned the global economy upside down and the resulting inflation pressures could take years to overcome. Is Australia headed for recession?
Look, it's not my base case, but it's certainly a risk. And I think the IMF is simply reflecting that risk. The reality is that the clock is ticking. There's talk of more talks between the US and Iran, but the key is that the flow of oil out of the Middle East needs to start up again pretty soon to avoid the recession scenario, because the reality is it's now starting to bite. Over the last 6 weeks, countries, including Australia, have still been getting oil because of the ships that had been coming out of the Middle East, then out of the refinery process, and they arrive in Australia. But eventually that will stop. There will be less oil going into refineries in Asia and therefore less refined product available to come to Australia. So that's a serious risk. And the longer the crisis continues, the blockage continues, the greater the risk that we do slide into recession as we have to eventually cut back on fuel usage.
The IMF paints a picture of stagflation. What is that and what does it mean for Australians?
Well, stagflation is a phenomenon that was quite common in the 1970s. And of course, that was partly related to oil shocks at the time. And that's a situation where you have a supply side shock to an economy that pushes up prices and constrains economic activity at the same time. So you end up with both higher inflation and lower economic growth, possibly recession and higher unemployment occurring simultaneously. We've had experienced little bits of that over the years, but it hasn't been a common phenomenon like it was in the 1970s. And the reality is that we are heading for some, at least a mild form of stagflation. Economists have already been revising up their inflation forecast. General talkers of inflation going up to around 5% could be higher if the situation in the Middle East isn't resolved quickly. And then, of course, at the same time, as Australians have to fork out more for fuel, they will cut back their spending. And if we get to a point where we're actually restricted in our fuel use, then that could actually cut back economic activity even further. And then you get a combination of higher inflation and weaker growth.
With a federal budget now just weeks away, how would Treasury officials be factoring this into their budget this year?
Look, I think this is a really difficult time for policymakers like the government and the Treasury, just as it is for the Reserve Bank, because you've got this double-edged sword hitting the economy. On the one hand, higher inflationary pressures, and on the other hand, a hit to economic activity at the same time. So I think and of course, federal government needs to be careful, because, as does the Reserve Bank, because you don't know how long the crisis is going to go for. If you overreact and do the wrong thing in the short term, you could damage things in the longer term. I suspect that the budget probably will, and the government seems to be heading in this direction, announce more cost of living support. But the key is that support be timely, impacts fairly quickly, temporary and targeted. In other words, that it doesn't blow budget spending out indefinitely, and that it's also targeted to those who actually need it, particularly low and middle income earners and those businesses that are most affected potentially by fuel shortages, along with high fuel costs. So we probably will see an element of that in the budget, but longer term, I think the government has to continue to focus on ways to boost productivity in the economy, because the reality is that the global economy has become more fraught. You can't rely on it being stable, as we found out over the last few years, and therefore we have to improve our own game, and that means making it easier for Australian businesses to employ people and make things.
AMP Chief Economist Shane Oliver. US President Donald Trump has foreshadowed a possible return to peace talks with Iran. His latest comments have come as Israel and Lebanon met for historic talks in Washington, D.C. But even the US mediators have acknowledged it's only the beginning of a long process. The Iran-backed militia Hezbollah was not party to the talks and says it will not abide by any resulting agreement. Chantelle Alkouri is in our Washington bureau. She joined me earlier.
Well, these direct talks between Lebanon and Israel are highly unusual. They concluded around 2 hours, but any sort of big breakthrough at this meeting was always going to be highly unlikely. Now, after the meeting, the US put out a statement saying that the talks covered the prospect of future direct negotiations. They said the participants held productive discussions on steps towards launching direct negotiations between Israel and Lebanon. Now, Lebanon went into this discussion wanting a ceasefire for Israel's attacks on the country to stop. Those attacks have killed more than 2,000 people and displaced more than 1.1 million since March, and Israel has been ramping up those strikes and its invasion since the war in Iran began. Israel, on the other hand, says it wants to disarm Hezbollah and says there will be no ceasefire with the group. Hezbollah is not party to these talks that have happened today. In a practical sense, Lebanon wouldn't be able to disarm Hezbollah. It does not have control over the group. I've been speaking to the International Crisis Group, who says that Israel and the US have been aggressively pushing for that disarmament of Hezbollah and for the Lebanese government to take steps that would essentially, potentially trigger a civil war. It also says that these talks today are a useful vehicle for the US to be able to manage the progress between Israel and Lebanon, given Israel's attacks are for them standing in the way of its already fragile ceasefire arrangement with Iran. Now, Hezbollah has responded to these talks. Before they happened, they said that they wouldn't abide to any agreements that came out of the talks. It had been urging the Lebanese government to pull out of the talks as well. And we know that both Hezbollah and Israel have since continued their attacks.
So how are people on the ground in both Lebanon and Israel feeling about the prospects of these talks?
Well, for many Lebanese people, it's hugely controversial and divisive for Lebanon to be meeting with Israel at all. There was a lot of scepticism because they see little guarantee that a diplomatic agreement would stop Israel's strikes on the country. For people in Israel that the ABC has spoken to, they've said that they're exhausted by the fighting. They want a resolution. We've heard from some of those people in both Lebanon and Israel from our colleagues who've spoken with them. Here's Michelle Karen, who lives in northern Israel.
I hope it will be useful for Israel and for Lebanon. But in my opinion, I can't think that it will help, because Hezbollah is more biggest than the government in Lebanon. They are not strong to bring a peace. But I hope they will bring something. We have to finish this.
We also heard from many in Lebanon who our colleagues from the ABC have spoken to. This is Larita Jajoud in southern Lebanon.
I hope that these negotiations in the end bring us to peace and safety, for us to finish with this war, not to reach negotiations or a ceasefire just for a few days like they did before. We had started to get our lives back, and now we're back to a war that's much harder than before.
That's Larita Jajoud in southern Lebanon. And Chantelle, Donald Trump is saying negotiations between the US and Iran could resume within days.
Yeah, that's right. The US president says that talks with Iran could resume after both parties failed to come to any sort of agreement in Islamabad on the weekend. He told the New York Post that something could be happening over the next 2 days, and he says we're more inclined to go there. Now, Gulf, Pakistani and Iranian officials also said negotiating teams from the US and Iran could return to Pakistan later this week. We know the US has meanwhile continued its blockade on Iranian ports, and that most ships already weren't moving through the strait since Iran's closure over a month ago. We also know that the US Central Command says no ships have made it past its naval blockade of Iran's ports, and 6 merchant ships have followed orders to turn back.
Chantelle Alkouri in Washington. Australia's tourism sector is cautiously waiting to see the impact from a Qantas decision to cut back its flights and raise prices. Airlines across the world are struggling with the rising cost of jet fuel and a drop in demand from travellers. Qantas will temporarily suspend 4 regional routes from next month, while a 5th route has no return date. Isabel Massali reports.
Sydney travel agent Helen George has been helping clients book flight routes that avoid the Middle East, but some no longer feel it's the right time for a holiday.
I've had about 30% of my customers cancel their future travel, even though it's outside of the what we call the disruption period, which was February, March and April. We're just finding that people now are just holding off making decisions in travelling to Europe.
She hopes consumer confidence will bounce back soon. But that depends on the war.
We spent a lot of time just looking at the existing bookings, you know, talking through to our clients, reassuring them, maybe readjusting their itineraries. For me, it's uncharted waters.
Australian Travel Industry Association CEO Dean Long has seen mixed consumer sentiment. Now there's a new challenge to navigate, with Qantas announcing it's made changes to its international network, increased fares and adjusted capacity to mitigate the impact of the conflict and highly volatile jet fuel prices.
Look, I think the reduction in the overall, the 5% reduction in the overall network size is a response to the global impact on increased aviation fuel. It's good that it's 5%.
The changes include a temporary suspension of 4 regional routes, but flights between Adelaide and Mount Gambier will stop next month until further notice. Affected customers are being offered alternative flights or refunds.
The longer this conflict goes on, the higher the aviation fuel prices are maintained. There will be increased pressure on airlines to reduce their schedules to those profitable routes, and that will unfortunately have an inflationary impact on the price that people are paying for their airfares.
The National Rural Health Alliance is less forgiving. Chief Executive Susie Teagan used to rely on flights out of Mount Gambier to access specialist health services for her child.
Those communities like Mount Gambier are already challenged in terms of service provision, being able to access care and access services that, you know, many people in the city take for granted.
Shadow Transport Minister Bridget McKenzie has the same concerns. She says at a recent Senate inquiry, Qantas gave no indication that it was considering flight cancellations.
Local travellers are going to be the ones that pay the price to keep Qantas international flights in the air. And that's a real kick in the guts for particularly rural and regional passengers who pay a higher price to access aviation services and a lower service provision.
In a statement, a spokesperson for Transport Minister Catherine King said the government is focused on securing fuel supply and is engaging strongly across the aviation sector. That includes weekly fuel security meetings with key representatives from airlines.
Isabel Massali reporting. The Coalition's new migration policy promises to lift Australia's immigration standards through measures including cutting migrant numbers and more intensive screening. But as Angus Taylor's first big test as opposition leader looms in next month's Farrer by-election, a former Liberal Party strategist has warned the key to winning back voters shed to One Nation isn't necessarily through the issue of migration. Here's political reporter Lexi Junewick.
Coalition leader Angus Taylor has pledged to put Australian values at the heart of the opposition's new immigration policy, but that pitch does nothing to change the heart of 77-year-old Brisbane local Garth, who's currently considering supporting One Nation.
Past governments and present governments will not even talk to each other in reference to our immigration policy. Have we got one?
61-year-old South Australian Vince, whose family migrated to Australia in the 1960s, now backs the minor party after voting for a major party his entire life.
When you see the government throwing money away to things that don't involve us, that just, I don't know, like we've got so much mess in our own backyard, we need to clean that up first.
The first instalment of the opposition's immigration policy was unveiled in a speech by Mr Taylor yesterday.
The coalition will make learning English an obligation for permanent visa holders, not an option.
The plan also promises to reduce immigration, increase screening of visa applicants via a legally binding Australian values test, and boot out those who don't abide by Australian values with the deportation task force. But Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke describes it as a diatribe entirely about sending a vibe to One Nation. Independent MP Zali Steggall agrees.
The coalition is desperate for relevance. They are losing votes to One Nation. So rather than coming up with a sensible policy around areas like housing, like good tax reform, like good support for small businesses that are struggling, they've presented this dog whistle to try and attract back One Nation voters.
Tony Barry is a former Liberal Party strategist and is now a director at Redbridge Group. He says the coalition's stance on migration isn't necessarily the way to win back votes from One Nation, which has seen the fastest polling rise in modern Australian politics.
I think there's certainly some political reward for having a strong policy on that issue, but they're going to get more reward by having a stronger policy on cost of living, housing, and probably tax reform is what underpins that.
A crucial test of Angus Taylor's leadership will materialise in the Farrer by-election in New South Wales next month. Tony Barry predicts independent Michelle Millthorpe and One Nation candidate David Farley will be the main contenders for the seat, most recently held by deposed Liberal leader Susan Lee for 25 years.
I think it will be a contest between the Teal independent and the One Nation candidate. Which means that preferences will be incredibly important.
Tony Barry from the Redbridge Group, ending that report by Lexi Junowick. Since Australia closed its refugee processing centres on Manus Island, the federal government has continued to give undisclosed sums of money to PNG to manage refugees there. But a hotel owner in the capital, Port Moresby, says he's owed over $11 million for housing the refugees, claiming he hasn't been paid since 2021. PNG correspondent Marion Farr reports.
When Australia began winding up its offshore processing centres on Manus Island in 2017, hotel owner Moser Kopioto struck a deal to accommodate some of them in Port Moresby.
We came into an understanding that they will pay me on a weekly basis.
He says the verbal agreement was reached with Australian Border Force officials, and for a few years, Australia paid the bills directly to his hotel.
We have no problem. Business is smooth, normal. We're all happy.
But in 2021, things changed. Australia announced it was ending its refugee program in Papua New Guinea and transferring responsibility for all remaining refugees to the PNG government. That's when, according to Moser Kopioto, the payments dried up. He claims he's now owed over $11 million and the debt continues to grow.
And it's really painful. It's really unfair. This can't operate like that. We can't operate.
Mr Kopioto has taken the PNG Immigration Department to court to claim the outstanding costs, but the PNG government has denied responsibility. Ralph Salop is the lawyer representing the hotel.
The refugees are still here, they're still being looked after, but unfortunately PNG Immigration Services has shifted the blame to Australia and said, no, it's not us, we're not responsible, but Australia is responsible.
Today, the National Court of PNG will hear an application to make the Commonwealth of Australia and the Department of Home Affairs defendants in the case. But the matter has raised bigger questions about the funding Australia has given to PNG to manage refugees.
So I would suggest to the Australian taxpayers that they ought to be asking themselves what Papua New Guinea has done with the money that Australia has given to it.
While the exact amount has never been disclosed, the Australian government says it made a substantial payment to PNG in 2021 and another in 2024. Green Senator David Shoebridge predicts an eye-watering figure.
What we do know from history is that the so-called Pacific solution costs hundreds of millions here, billions of dollars there.
In 2023, the PNG government announced an audit after allegations the refugee funds had been misused, but the results have never been publicised. Senator Shoebridge says the public deserves answers.
How much money has Australia given to the Papua New Guinea government for this cohort of men and their families? And what is it that we're meant to be seeing in return?
The Australian Department of Home Affairs told the ABC it doesn't have any role in the ongoing management of individuals remaining in PNG.
Marion Farr, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. What does Trump's blockade in the Strait of Hormuz mean for our fuel supply? Well, it's not great. Today, Sol Kavanagh, energy expert at MST Financial, on why we're facing a doomsday scenario that's been wargamed for decades. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.